Last time we were all here was almost a month ago, and we did the first third of Joseph's life. We talked about his being sold into slavery and his being falsely accused by Potiphar's wife. Then we canceled because it was really icy out, and then we canceled again last week, but then a bunch of young people were like, we will still want to meet. So we all were at Wendy's house, Wendy and Eric's house, the Quaken house. You were included.
No, I mean, it's also my house.
It's the Quaken house. It's the Quaken house. And we did actually walk through the material that I was going to go over last week. So for those of you who missed out, we are jumping now to the final part of Joseph's life tonight. You can, however, listen to the recording of last week's talk at the Quaken house. Actually, the recording worked pretty well. I put it in the middle of the room, and everybody's comments, we could hear everybody. So, I did not. It was quite funny, so I kept it. The timing of it, Wendy, was perfect. I mean, I listened to it. I went to go find the spot to delete it, and then the exchange that happened between me and you, I was like, oh, that's gold. We're going to keep that. So, anyway. So tonight we're looking at the last part of Joseph's life. So last week, just a quick recap, we noticed, one of the things that we noticed was that Joseph's situation is not being changed by his own maneuvering, his own striving. That there's that scene when the chief cupbearer comes into the prison, and Joseph predicts that he'll be restored, and then he says to Joseph, Joseph says to the cupbearer, remember me when you get back into power, and because I've been wallowing here unjustly. And then the text tells us that the cupbearer forgot. And then magically 2 years later, he discovers again that Joseph's down in the prison and that he'd promised to say something about him. Our observation about that was that when Joseph is trying to get himself out of prison, it didn't go anywhere. Because God really wanted to make it clear to Joseph that he's the one who's the architect of his fortunes. You know, the guy magically remembering two random years later is a sign of God's presence in the narrative. Even though the text doesn't directly say that God was responsible for that forgetting and remembering, it seems in light of the sort of overall arc of the patriarchal narrative, starting with Abraham, that the story moves forward because God makes it move forward and not because human beings are trying to make it move forward. And we actually see examples in the patriarchs' lives of them trying to make it move forward and it doesn't work. So I thought that was a faithful reading of the text. We found that Joseph's time in prison was a time of great humbling, that when he's called upon again to use his gift, that gift with which he sort of beat his brothers over the head at the beginning of his story, gets him into serious trouble. Now when he's asked to use it, he's using it to serve others. He tells Pharaoh point blank, it's not in my power, it's of the Lord to reveal these dreams to you. And we saw how God, in restoring Joseph to power, he was... So you remember that he was stripped of his garments each time he was humiliated, first by his brothers who took off his multicolored coat, and then again he was stripped of his garment by Potiphar's wife when she falsely accused him of trying to seduce her. And so his deprivation is symbolized in the narrative by losing clothing. Then when he's restored to power, he's actually reclothed twice. He puts on a new fresh garment when Pharaoh calls him out of prison. And then after Pharaoh is so impressed by his ability to read dreams, remember, Pharaoh puts a nice robe on him as a sign of his new office within Egypt. So he's stripped of his garments twice. He's then reclothed twice, signaling his return to fortune. And of course, this is part of the larger story within the patriarchal narrative that God, as he promised to Abraham, that he would, through Abraham's descendants, bless the nations. So the nations are being blessed by Joseph's ministry in Egypt to provide for people during a famine. And we spent a little time looking at his sort of the welfare system he puts together, which is interesting. Well, I'll leave it at that. Go listen to last week's talk if you want to learn more. Of course, the narrative ends provocatively. Joseph marries an Egyptian woman, has two kids with her, Ephraim and Manasseh. And the names of one of them means that he's forgotten about all of his trials and tribulations of his former life, and he's forgotten about his father's household, which creates this sort of pregnant tension in the narrative. At this point, we've moved far away from Canaan. We have no idea what's going on now with Jacob and his other sons. They're the lineage that God promised to Abraham, and now all of a sudden the story focuses exclusively on Joseph, who's not in Canaan, doesn't know them, doesn't interact with them, and has now forgotten all about him, according to the way he's named his son. So how is it going to go forward? How is God's promise to Abraham going to advance if the hero now is detached from that line? That's the segue into what happens tonight. It's interesting how long this section is. I don't have a good explanation for you why it's so long. It's the longest single narrative block in the entire book of Genesis, with the possible exception of Genesis 1 through 11, the so-called primordial history, if you read that as one chunk. But it's still, even that's multiple stories. These chapters in Genesis, we're talking now chapters 42 through 50, so it's the whole last, like, almost tenth of the last fifth of the book, is entirely focused on Joseph. He's not even the firstborn son, for crying out loud, of the line of promise. So it's strange that the Genesis narrative has slowed down so dramatically and it's focusing so exclusively on Joseph. And in this section of tonight's story is the longest part of the Joseph narrative. It's chapter 42 through the end. So that's just tonight's story. Joseph's story starts in chapter 39. Here, come forward, guys. There's not a whole lot of us. Let's be cozy. Let's be cozy here. Come on. So that's where we are. So now all of a sudden we are going to find out what happens to Joseph when he meets his brothers again. And let me just stop here and pose the question to you. Joseph's life was seriously disrupted by what his brothers did to him. And they sold him into slavery, for crying out loud. They cut him off from his family. All of his misfortunes that followed were a direct result of that initial betrayal by his brothers. How do you respond to somebody after having not seen them for many years, who the last time you did see them caused you incredible harm, either actual violence or maybe just spiritual violence to your person? I mean, what do you do with that? What do you guys, just put it out there to you, just for the sake of discussion. What would you expect to be the response?
A big grudge.
Sure, yeah. It's only human.
Passive-aggressive comments.
I'm not sure how often passive-aggressive aggression occurs in the biblical narrative, but it's certainly possible.
Spite,
anger, yeah. What else?
He could do what they had done to him.
Sure, he could treat them roughly, right? Of course, the great tension in the narrative is that now he's risen to power. He's the second most powerful man in Egypt, which at this time in world history is one of the great empires of the world. This is not some backwater power. This is one of the three major ancient powers. At this point in the history of Egypt, Egypt has actually already been around for several thousand years. When Joseph arrives in Egypt, the Great Pyramid of Giza will have been there for as long as we are now separated from Christ. It was built around 4000 BC. So it's very old. Egypt's an old, established civilization. Joseph's now the second most powerful man in it. So he meets his brothers. He is in a position to do them all worlds of hurt, right? And you'd almost expect that to happen because they screwed him. They really made his life terrible. We're going to see tonight what God has been doing in Joseph this whole time. We've gotten glimpses of it in the way he responded to Pharaoh. We're going to see even more detail tonight, just exactly what God was doing in Joseph's heart. So we start in chapter 42. Remember, there's a great famine in the land. Joseph has provided within Egypt to provide for people, and now the famine is spreading around, and more people are hungry. That's where we start. When Jacob, now we're back to Joseph's father. When Jacob learned that there was a grain for sale in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you look at one another?" And he said, "Behold, I have heard that there is grain for sale in Egypt. Go down and buy grain for us there that we may live and not die." So 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. But Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with his brothers, for he feared that harm might happen to him. Thus the sons of Israel came to buy among the others who came, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. Okay, what's so significant about Jacob not sending Benjamin? Let's go back to our very first night when we were all together here. We talked about Jacob's wives. Who is Jacob's favorite?
Rachel.
And who did Rachel mother?
Joseph
and Benjamin. And who, therefore, was Jacob's favorite at the beginning of this whole narrative? Joseph was, right? Now, Benjamin's all he's got left from Rachel. Remember, Rachel gives birth, dies giving birth to Benjamin. And so Jacob's favorite wife is lost as a result of her pregnancy with Benjamin. He's not going to send Benjamin. He's afraid of what might happen to him. So he just sends the 10 down to go and get food. Okay. That's going to be important that Benjamin's not there. Now, Joseph was governor over the land. Now we're back in Egypt. He was the one who sold to all the people of the land, telling us what we already know. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. What's significant about that? Right, the sheaf of wheat, the bag. Joseph predicted this way back when he was 17 years old. This was his vision that he told his brothers was going to happen. And that's why they hated him. And here they are bowing down to the ground before him. So Joseph is a truth teller. Even if he's a snotty truth teller, he is a truth teller. Even if he used this divine gift to abuse others rather than to build up, which is a warning to all of us, if we have a divine gift, not to assume that we can therefore not abuse it. We certainly can, even if it's from God. Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he treated them like strangers and spoke roughly to them. "Where do you come from?" he said. They said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food." And Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. It's telling us that exact same detail now twice in as many verses. And Joseph remembered the dreams that he had dreamed of them. And he said to them, "You are spies. You have come to see the nakedness of the land." They said to him, "No, my lord, your servants have come to buy food. We are all sons of one man. We are honest men. Your servants have never been spies." He said to them, "No, it is the nakedness of the land that you have come to see." He's accusing them of being foreign armies, foreign invaders, scouts in an advanced army who are going to see how the famine has decimated Egypt so that they might invade it, you know, capitalize on its weakness. And they said, verse 13, we, your servants, are 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. Notice that they said they were 12 brothers. There's only 10 of them there. And behold, the youngest is this day with our father, and one is no more. But Joseph said to them, "It is as I said to you, you are spies. By this you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not go from this place unless your brother, your youngest brother, comes here. Send one of you and let him bring the other while you remain confined, that your words may be tested whether there is truth in you. Or else by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies." And he put them all in custody 3 days. Interestingly enough, he's testing them to see if their words are true. This is exactly the kind of way that the law of Moses calls the people of Israel to test the words of prophets. If their words come true, you know they're genuine prophets. If their words don't come true, if they incite you to idolatry by their false words, you kill them. And if their words are just untrue, don't be afraid of them. Joseph, of course, is a prophet. He's seen the future, and they hated him for it. They didn't test his words. Now they're proving true. He's now testing them. Quick question. What's Joseph's interest in Benjamin? Like, why? Where's the youngest? I'll tell you what. You bring the youngest in here, and then I'll know that you're telling the truth. It's his brother. That's a very interesting insight, Wendy. And as the narrative plays out, there could be some real truth to that. He wants to see if his brothers are the same old rascals they were when they sold him into slavery. The kids downstairs think that he might be. On the third day, Joseph said to them, "Do this and you will live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers remain confined where you are in custody, and let the rest go and carry grain for the famine of your households. And bring your youngest brother to me, so your words will be verified and you shall not die." And they did so. They said to one another, okay, just real quick, let's stop there. So he had confined, there's 10 of them, he's confined to 9 of them and said, "Send one back to bring back your brother." 3 days have passed, he's now changed his tune. Okay, I'm just going to keep one of you and 9 of you can go back. And if you bring your brother back to me, I'll know you're legit. Then they said to one another, this is verse 21. In truth, we are guilty concerning our brother, and that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us, and we did not listen. That is why this distress has come upon us. What are they saying right now? Not quite repenting, but they are connecting their current situation to that. What's the connection? Right. And they're saying this in front of Joseph. And Reuben answered them. Now, remember Reuben's role in the story? What was Reuben's plan when he found out what his brothers were planning on doing to Joseph? Who's going to rescue him? He's going to come back later and pull him out of the well where they had left him. Right? And then when he goes back later and sees that he's missing, I think the idea there is that Reuben wasn't present when they sold him into slavery, so he wasn't able to stop it. He comes back later. Joseph's not there. He tears his robes. Reuben answered them, "Did I not tell you not to sin against the boy? But you did not listen. So now there comes a reckoning for his blood." They did not know that Joseph understood them, for there was an interpreter between them. Then he turned away from them and wept. Why do you suppose he's crying? Didn't know what? Right. That certainly adds a depth to his brothers that he may not have been aware of before. Why is he crying? The text doesn't tell us explicitly why he's weeping, but I think we're supposed to imply why he's crying.
It's more or less an admission of guilt.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some real sorrow on their part.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of identifying with their dilemma.
Yeah.
That they think their brother is dead.
Yeah.
And here he's hiding the fact for a moment.
Right. So he's using an interpreter. So he looks Egyptian. They don't recognize him. Of course, Joseph's brothers are a lot older than him, right? So he recognizes them because they probably haven't. So he was 17, he's now 30. That many years have passed. We don't know how many. So he was 30 when he was restored to power in Pharaoh's court. So it's now 7 years of plenty. It's in the beginning of the 7 years of famine. So how old is he now? He's 38 probably. So about 20 years have passed since he last saw his brothers. His oldest brothers, Judah, Simeon, Reuben, they would have been old. They would have been grown men when he last saw them. So they probably haven't changed all that much in appearance. He recognizes them. He, of course, was a 17-year-old boy. Canaanite men didn't shave their beards. Egyptian men did. You know, Joseph looks like he's Egyptian, and he's talking to them through an interpreter, which means he's speaking Egyptian to them and having it interpreted. So they have no reason to recognize him, and he's overhearing their conversation. And they're repentant about what he's done. Not quite repentant, because repentant implies change of course. They're at least sorrowful about it. And he's also now finding out that Reuben wasn't party to the choice. We see a tenderness here in Joseph for the first time. He weeps several more times in this narrative. And I'll comment on that at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He must die.
That's possible. Yeah, I mean, I think the consensus of the interpretive tradition on this point is that his brothers were active agents in his being sold into slavery. I mean, I think you're right to notice in the text it's a bit ambiguous. So it's plausible, but I think that
either way
they're guilty, right? I mean. They certainly haven't heard from him. It's been 20 years. They sold their brother into slavery. You'd think if he was still alive, he might have tried to come home. Either way, they know they're responsible for his not being there. Be like Blake. Notice the details. Details are always important in biblical narrative. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so actually, I remember a commentator saying the Midianites and Ishmaelites is probably a reference to the same group of traitors. You'll see that all the time in Hebrew narrative where there's the same entity has multiple names, and you see both names just being ascribed without explanation, one verse to the next. And so I think most interpreters see the Ishmaelites and the Midianites as the same.
Verse 15 indicates that
Yeah. Well, at any rate, live or not, he's no longer around, and they're responsible. And he returned to them and spoke to them, and he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. And Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain and to replace every man's money in his sack and to give them provisions for the journey. This was done for them. Okay. So he gives them money. He gives them food. He then returns their money to them. As they are going home, they discover that the money is in their bags. Where does it say that? Then they loaded their donkeys with their grain and departed. As one of them opened his sack and gave his donkey fodder at the lodging place, he saw his money in the mouth of his sack. He said to his brothers, "My money has been put back. Here it is in the mouth of my sack." And their hearts failed them, and they turned trembling to one another, saying, "What is this that God has done to us?" And then when they get home and they explain to their father what happened, fast forwarding to verse 35, as they emptied their sacks, behold, every man's bundle of money was in a sack. So one guy discovers he's got his money. Now they all discover they've got their money. And when they and their father saw their bundles of money, they were afraid. Why are they afraid?
I just wonder which ones of them are thinking, "Just let them keep Simeon and we won't go back."
I'm happy you asked that question, Cliff, because I think someone does come to that conclusion. Yeah, Tim. I think it might be, I mean, at this point, the narrative doesn't fully tell us. I think by the time the narrative's over, we'll know why Joseph's crying. At the very least, we're seeing him overwhelmed emotionally by what he's seeing, that a raw nerve is being hit. Like, what are the odds? Yeah, it's an intense moment. Yeah. Because it says that he remembered his dreams when he saw them again. So maybe he hadn't been thinking about it. He's so content in his new life, as is suggested by what he named one of his kids, that having it all come back to him in one moment is just like, it's just too much.
I think there's something really powerful going on that causes him to bleed. That is that he's starting to see sort of the wheels of justice turn. Mm-hmm.
Sure. And certainly we know at this point in the story that Joseph has come to a deeper appreciation of how God works in the world, right? I mean, that's been pointed out in the way he responded to Pharaoh, and Joseph's time in suffering and were not wasted spiritually. He was growing in God during that time. And so I think to your point, Phil, and I think this is going to be, as the narrative progresses, we're going to know more and more about what's going on in Joseph's heart. Yeah, that could very well be. He's just moved by the grandeur of it all. Okay. So why are they afraid here with the money in their sacks? Because they haven't paid for it.
First they're spies, now they're
thieves. Right, right.
And Pharaoh made exact justice.
Right, because they have to go back, right? They got to bring back their little brother to get Simeon back. Cliff wants to know, but let's just not go back. It's just not worth it. And Jacob, their father, said to them, "You have bereaved me, my children. Joseph is no more, and Simeon is no more." Dad, didn't we just tell you he's still alive? And if we just bring back Benjamin, we can get him back? His dad gives up on him. He's so unwilling to let Benjamin be put at risk that he's going to let Simeon go. Like, you've cost me Simeon now, too. It's like, Simeon's dead. Simeon's still alive. So it's Jacob who gives up on Simeon. Then Reuben said to his father, "Kill my two sons if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my hands and I will bring him back to you." But he, that is Jacob, said, "My son shall not go down with you, for his brother indeed, and he is the only one left." Can you imagine if you're the nine other brothers at this point who are hearing your father say this? He's the only one left. What about the rest of us? Jacob is still obviously playing favorites with his boys. Will his boys take the bait now, though, is the question, right? Because they did before. They sold Joseph into slavery over their jealousy of him. So that we're seeing the same pressures being brought to bear on his brothers again. You know, just the same favoritism. And Reuben's now offering his own sons, but the father will not let them go back. The father gives up on Simeon. If harm should happen to him on the journey that you are to make, you would bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to Sheol. He cares more about Benjamin than he cares about Simeon. I mean, I don't know what other conclusion you come to from this. In light of how we know his brothers have responded in the past about these kinds of things, we're waiting for the explosion to happen again. Okay. Beginning of chapter 43, they run out of food. And so Jacob's like, hey, go back to Egypt. And they're like, hello, Dad, what did we tell you would happen? The man solemnly warned us, saying, you shall not see my face unless your brother is with you. If you will send out our brother with us, we will go down and buy you food. But if you will not send him, we will not go down. For the man said to us, you shall not see my face unless your brother is with you. Israel said, that's Jacob, why did you treat me so badly to tell man that you had another brother? He's angry at them. He's, you know, this is what happens when you're in a tough spot. You keep trying to find ways to, like, blame somebody for the problem. Like, why'd you tell the guy that you had another brother? It's like, how are we supposed to know? He was just examining us. We just answered his questions. Okay. The money shot, though, is at the end of this section, verses 8 and 9. And Judah said to his father. Now, before I continue with what Judah said, what was Judah's role in what happened to Joseph? You guys remember? Somebody other than Leah. Somebody other than Tim.
Why?
Because you guys always answer the questions. What's Judah's role? That's right. It's Judah's idea to sell him into slavery. So there are two named brothers in the account with Joseph's being sold. Reuben, who wants to save him, and Judah, who's like, I got an idea. He's the brains of the operation. Of course, there's been an interesting interlude with Judah that we'll get to in a moment. Judah said to Israel, his father, send the boy with me, and we will arise and go the way that we may live and not die, both we and you and also our little ones. I will be a pledge of his safety. From my hand you shall acquire him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame forever. If we are not delayed, we would have now returned twice. What's Judah doing here? Right. What is that in theological terms? He's a substitute, right? He's putting himself in place of his brother, saying, let it be on me if something happens to him, right? Judah's grown up a lot here. A lot's happened to Judah. The whole episode with Dinah, and then his brothers, his sons' wives. I won't go into detail of that story because we don't have time for that, but Judah learns hard lessons himself about what it means to be faithful to God's commandments, even if it's hard on you. And he's grown up. He's offered himself for his brother. And it's remarkable that Judah should be the primary character in this story that does that in light of the great substitution of Judah's ultimate heir, who is Jesus of the tribe of Judah. Yeah, Cliff.
I'm still feeling for Simeon.
It's funny, like, Simeon's not, how he fares is not mentioned at all. I mean, when he shows up again, it's not, it's just.
But Joseph is just letting him rot.
Yeah, yeah.
It seems like Judah is taking over leadership of the family.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so Reuben tries, right?
Of course, the oldest is Simeon, and he's now out of the picture.
Reuben's the oldest, Simeon's the second.
Yes. The situation with Dinah, right.
But, and Reuben has been disqualified because he slept with Jacob's confidant, but, Reuben tries first. You know, if bring Benjamin with me and if he dies, you can kill my two sons.
Right.
Great offer. But then Judah steps up and is like, no, okay.
Kill me. Right, he's taking, I think it's a very insightful observation, Blake, that Judah is taking leadership of the family at this point. Yeah.
Why did they refer to Benjamin?
had to have been alive when Joseph was sold.
Sure, yeah.
And Joseph was 17, and we mm-hmm. know that he's at least 37 now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I suspect it's a literary flourish that he, you know, as old as he is now, he's got to be in his early 20s at least. His father is still viewing him as this precious little thing that he can't let go of. So he's always the baby of the family. Yeah. Okay. So they get back to Egypt. Judah's grown up. Jumping out of verse 26. They get to Egypt, they bring the money back with them. They bring back, you know, Jacob's idea is to bring back all the money and even some gifts to sort of placate any wrath for what's happened with the money. They get there, they explain the whole thing. They're waiting for Joseph to come home. Verse 26 of chapter 43, when Joseph came home, they brought into the house to him the present that they had with them and bowed down to him to the ground. How many dreams did Joseph have that his brothers would bow down to him? Two. And how many times now have they bowed down to him?
Twice.
They're not going to bow down to him again. I think that's interesting, the details in the narrative. The writer's very, very particular about what he's doing. Joseph had two dreams they'd bow down to him. They've now bowed down to him twice. In actuality, they've done it. Of course, they still don't know who he is. I don't remember, but we'll get to that. We'll see what happens. And he inquired about their welfare and said, "Is your father well, the old man of whom you spoke? Is he still alive?" They said, "Your servant, our father, is well. He is still alive." And they bowed their heads and prostrated themselves. And he lifted up his eyes and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son, and said, "Is this your youngest brother of whom you spoke to me? God be gracious to you, my son." Then Joseph hurried out, for his compassion grew warm for his brother, and he sought a place to weep. And he entered his chamber and wept there. Then he washed his face and came out, and controlling himself, said, "Serve the food." Why is Joseph weeping? Why is Joseph weeping? Because of Benjamin, right? And why would that cause him to? It's his brother. You know, these other guys were his brothers too. This is his whole brother. His same mother. The English here is interesting. For his compassion grew warm for his brother. The word compassion in the Hebrew is the word rachamim, which means bowels. And compassion for the ancient Hebrew is that place in the person from the deepest spring of where your feelings come from. And for them, the language is literal. It's that gut organ that's the hardest to get to when you open up somebody. So it's kind of an interesting way we see in the Hebrew language that sort of concrete way of conveying ideas. And actually in Greek, isn't the word compassion in Greek from like the word for kidneys? Splagitsomai or something like that? Anyway, whatever. So he serves them food. He gives food to his brothers. He gives them all a portion. And then he gives Benjamin five times the amount of food. It's funny that this little detail is kind of passed over in silence. I mean, what are his brothers thinking when they see this display on Joseph's part for Benjamin? All we know is that he did it. We don't get his brothers' reactions to it. But they do have a good time. They seem to have fun. Yeah, I suspect for like members this high up in the hierarchy, their diet probably didn't change a whole lot. Just a quick historical note here. It says that the Egyptians don't eat with Hebrews because it's an abomination to them. The reason why, plainly, is that Egyptians were actually mostly vegetarian, whereas the Hebrews did eat meat. And of course, these guys are herders, so they would have certainly eaten the meat that they're attending to. And so the Egyptians worshipped livestock as gods. And so to eat one, it's sort of like eating a hamburger in India today. You don't do it. It might be someone's grandma, right? So the Egyptians don't eat the kind of meat that the Hebrews are accustomed to eating. They worshipped the kinds of things that the Hebrews ended up eating. It's interesting that when the Israelites, having been formed totally within the culture of Egypt, go to make for themselves an idol in the wilderness, it's a calf, which is what the Egyptians worship, right? So that's why they don't eat together. Okay. I'm turning over my paper almost to halfway mark. That's a good sign. Joseph tests his brothers again. He lets them go on their way, but then he has all the money put back in their sack, and then he takes one of his own silver goblets and has it put in Benjamin's sack. And then they go on their way. They discover that they leave. Joseph then sends a guard after them to catch them in the act that he himself orchestrated. This is actually, some American law enforcement people do this. It's called entrapment. And it's sometimes illegal to do it quite the way that it's sometimes done. Because you can't set up someone to break a law and then like arrest them for breaking the law. But Joseph's doing that here. He's not living under British common law here in the United States. Sends him back. Why have you done evil for good? His brothers are like, what? What are you talking about? And then they tell the story. And Judah, I think it's Judah who offers. Where is this? This is verse 13, 44. Behold, money that we found in the house. He said, let it be as you say. I don't know who he is here. Probably Judah. Anyway, one of the brothers basically says that, like, look, we haven't done what you're saying, but just so we're all clear, why don't you go ahead and search through all the sacks, and whoever's found, whoever has the cup on them will be the one who's guilty. Of course, they're thinking that it's not going to happen, right? They're thinking that, like, then they'll let us go. And then they find the cup in Benjamin's sack. And Judah has now offered his own life in place of Benjamin's if something were to happen to him. So instead of going back to their father, they go back into the city. Then they tore their clothes and they returned to the city. 44, verse 14. When Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house, he was still there. They fell before him to the ground. I guess I was incorrect. They do bow down more than once. Joseph said to them, What deed is this that you have done? Do you not know that a man like me can indeed practice divination? He's totally bluffing. He orchestrated the whole thing. And Judah said, so it's Judah who's talking for the family. What shall we say to my lord? What shall we speak? Or how can we clear ourselves? God has found out the guilt of your servants. Behold, we are my lord's servants, both we and he also, in whose hand the cup has been found. But he said, far be it from me, that's Joseph now, far be it from me that I should do so. Only the man in whose hand the cup was found shall be my servant. But as for you, go up in peace to your father. So he's offering to let them go. This is their out, right? Their father loves Benjamin more than them. He thinks he's more valuable than the rest of them. Like, are they going to repeat the same behavior again? Cliff, you want to make a comment? Yeah, I was incorrect. Your pastor is capable of erring, my brother. That's why we're Protestants. Okay, so fast forwarding, Judah explains to Joseph the whole, he basically repeats the entire narrative up to this point. Just, this is all that happened. And then jumping now to verse 30. So he's explained to him why he can't give them Benjamin. Like, we can't leave him here. You need to understand that his father loves him more than he loves us, and if we go down there without him, he'll die. So he doesn't seem to be, he's admitting that this is the situation with his father, and now there's not envy and enmity, there's compassion. Verse 30, now therefore, as soon as I come down to your servant my father, and the boy is not with us, then as his life is bound up to the boy's life, as soon as he sees that the boy is not with us, he will die, and your servants will bring down the gray hairs of your servant, our father, with sorrow to Sheol. For your servant became a pledge. Now he's talking about himself. Your servant, me, became a pledge of safety for the boy to my father, saying, if I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father all my life. Now therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the boy as a servant to my lord, and let the boy go back to his brothers. For how can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? I fear to see the evil that would find my father. He's offering himself in place of his brother. He's saying, take me instead, please, just take me instead. The level of sacrifice here is extraordinary. The narrative is going out of its way to say they had every out they possibly could have. They could have just left Benjamin and kept going to Canaan. No, they went back. Joseph says, no, you guys can all leave. I'm just keeping this one. Judah fights. No, you can't, you don't understand. I can't let you have him. So Judah is, going out of his way to offer himself for his brother, even in light of this, the injustice of the fact that his father loves Benjamin more than he loves them. I mean, it's extraordinary, the sacrifice. Judah is offering himself as an intermediary and a substitute for his brother. And of course, Judah was the one who orchestrated the entire fiasco to begin with. So when Joseph sees this, he breaks down. He can't handle it anymore. Beginning of 45, then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him. He cried, "Make everyone go out from me." So no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud so that the Egyptians heard it and the household of Pharaoh heard it. And Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" How do his brothers react to this sudden curveball that's just been thrown their way? But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. They don't believe him. Or if they do, it's just so, like, they're in shock. Like, now, like, their fortunes have just completely turned around. And they're overwhelmed by what they're seeing unfold in front of them. Joseph's overwhelmed. They're overwhelmed. They can't say anything. So Joseph says, "Please come near to me, please." And they came near, and he said, "I am your brother, Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been great in the land these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep you alive for many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and ruler over all the land of Egypt. Hurry and go up to my father and say to him, 'Thus says to your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all of Egypt.'" I mean, he's just... What's happened in Joseph's heart over these last 20 years? What's his analysis of what's happened to him? He just lays it all out right here. Right, he thinks it's a good that's happened. He becomes a Calvinist. Look, here's the Institutes. Here's John Calvin's Institutes. No, not quite. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. What a remarkable thing to say for a man, to a bunch of people that had, last time he saw them, completely violated trust and committed a terrible deed of violence against him. He's convinced that God was at work, despite themselves. He admits that they didn't intend it for that way. He says that later. But he sees God at work, even in the midst of human evil, and he recognizes now that he's this whole time been an instrument of God. All of his sufferings, all of the injustice that he experienced, all of it was leading up to this moment. And it's interesting what he says. God sent me before you to preserve, first thing in verse 6, and verse 5, God sent me before you to preserve life. So just kind of in general, to give bread to the people, to be able to sell it to them during the famine. But then he goes on to say, and God sent me before you, verse 7, to preserve for you a remnant on earth. So not only was this orchestrated by God to preserve life for the Egyptians and for all the surrounding nations who benefit from Joseph and his pre-planning, Joseph's now seeing that his being sold into slavery and being put into prison so that he would eventually meet Pharaoh's servant, who would eventually bring him to Pharaoh, who would eventually bring him to power so that he could save all these people, this also is what's enabling him to save for his own family a line. And the whole narrative is being driven by God's promise to Abraham, "I will make your descendants great. There will be as numerous as stars in the sky, and they will bless the nations." This is what the story is about. And Joseph is now seeing the big picture. All of my sufferings, all of the things that God put me through, was all him behind the scenes making sure that my people would have a lineage. Right? So he's a seer, all right. He now sees more fully than he ever has before in his life. Exactly how it's going on. And then in verse 15, then he fell upon his brother, verse 14, he fell on his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept upon his neck, and he kissed all his brothers and wept upon them. And after that, his brothers talked with him. What do you suppose they talked about? Sure they did. What'd you do with the money? What'd you do with the money? Whatever provocative little detail in the biblical narrative. And they talked, and he talked with his brothers. They're probably wondering, Joseph, how did you become Lord of all of Egypt? Last time we saw you, you were going away as a slave. I mean, they're catching up. I'm sure Judas told them stories about the family's happenings. And now their hearts are disclosed. They know each other. And there's peace. And it's all because God this whole time has been working on Joseph and on Judah as they've been getting older. Yeah, Cliff. That's a good question. What was he trying to do? Tim?
He was trying to see if they changed.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, last time he saw them, what happened? I mean, he was sold into slavery by their malice and envy.
Did they maybe fail the first test because they left Simeon?
Well, that was Joseph's fault. I mean, that was the arrangement he made with them. So I don't know if they... It's possible.
Well, I think the significance for the second test is that Benjamin. So Benjamin is Rachel's son,
right?
Who's the favorite of Jacob, right? So they don't have beef against Simeon. But they have beef, the same beef against Benjamin that they would have had against Joseph, right? I mean, right. They resented Joseph because he was the favorite wife, he was the one that the father loved. And so he's the one that they Joseph is going to see, like, okay.
So Joseph kept Simeon in an effort for them to bring Benjamin. It's all about Benjamin.
Well, I think he wanted to see his brother. I mean, I think the whole thing is, I think that the idea that he's trying to see who his brothers are now is true. He's trying to see, like, have they changed? Are they the same old brothers? You know, before he reveals himself to them, he wants to know what's going to happen. Yeah. I think it's a very poignant observation, Blake. It's redemption fully. I mean, in every way that the story can be reversed, that's what we're seeing happening. It gets even better. The details are wonderful. So he tells them to go get their father. In verse 21 of chapter 45, he says, "And Joseph gave them wagons according to the command of Pharaoh." Pharaoh's heard all about this now and was like, "This is great news. Go bring your father, bring him back." "And gave them provisions for the way for the journey, and to each and all of them he gave a change of clothes, but to Benjamin he gave 100 shekels of silver and 5 changes of clothes." Remember the significance of clothing in this whole narrative arc? Losing clothing is a sign of deprivation, humiliation, suffering. Gaining clothes is a sign of restoration, reconciliation. He's clothing his brothers. They stripped him of his garment at the beginning of the story. And now he's clothing them, he's providing for them. I mean, again, it's reversal. And it's interesting, again, the tightness of the details. And the author is being quite intentional about all this, what he tells us. In my mind, it's a mark of the genius of the text, its divine origin. I mean, God is quite capable of inspiring human authors to make this say what it says. Of course, the narrative itself is playing out in fact because God is orchestrating it. And then he says to his brothers in verse 24, "Do not quarrel on the way." No explanation, you know, just like maybe he still knows his brothers, I guess. I don't know. Don't quarrel on the way. So he brings his father in. Fast forwarding now to chapter 47. 46 just conveys how they came back into Egypt, describes all the names of their sons and wives and how they all came into the land of Goshen. 47, he presents his brothers to Pharaoh, tells them who they are. Pharaoh agrees to give them the land of Goshen where they can dwell, offers to recruit some of them to be his own royal sheepherders. And then starting in verse 7 of chapter 47, Let's back up a quick. You asked if Jacob bows before Joseph. So Joseph presents himself to him, falls on his neck. Israel said to Joseph, "Now let me die since I've seen you." I don't think so, Blake. Anyway, I'll look closely a little bit later for the sake of time. Chapter 47, verse 7, "Then Joseph brought in Jacob his father and stood him before Pharaoh. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Jacob, 'How many are the days of the years of your life?' And Jacob said to the Pharaoh, 'The days of the years of my sojourning are 130 years. Verse 10, "And Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from the presence of Pharaoh." Remember what the book of Hebrews says about who blesses who? In the ancient Near East, who blesses who? The greater blesses the lesser. And here we have this homeless Canaanite sheepherder blessing Pharaoh of Egypt. Not once, but twice. And he's so old. I mean, I think sometimes we look at these numbers. Skeptics say, clearly the narrative can't be true because no one lives that long. But in the narrative itself, Pharaoh is surprised by how old he is. How old are you? People don't live this long, even in this day, right? It's a sign of God's blessing on them. Pharaoh's like, wow, you're... So Pharaoh receives this elder statesman's blessing. Chapter 47, we then find out that Jacob adopts Joseph's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, and he blesses them, but he switches the order of blessing and he gives the senior blessing to the younger of the two brothers. Why is that? Why do you suppose Joseph's two sons become Jacob's instead of Joseph's in terms of like the legality of inheritance? What's the significance of that? Joseph now counts basically for two in his father's family. I think there is a reason. Why Jacob now basically? So if you have 12 brothers, they each get an equal portion of the inheritance. Joseph now gets two portions because his two kids are now part of the family line. Yeah. It's an interesting idea. I don't think that's the main reason, but it's a provocative idea. Maybe Simeon didn't make it after all. According to Deuteronomy 21, verse 17, the oldest brother in a family is obliged to receive double the inheritance of the rest of his brothers as a sign of his being the oldest. And it was a way that the law is explicit about this. You mark the honor of the oldest brother by giving him double. And so, for example, when Elisha asks Elijah at the end of his life for a double portion, he's not actually asking Elijah to have even more power than Elijah did. What he's asking is, basically, make me your firstborn son. Adopt me is what he's asking for as your firstborn. So to receive the double portion is a sign that after all this time, Joseph is the eldest brother in his father's eyes. You know, he receives the best of the inheritance. His line now gets, you know, he gets two lines in his father's lineage. This Ephraim and Manasseh bit is, again, sort of looking forward. Ephraim becomes the most powerful of the 10 tribes in the northern part of Israel. The capital of Samaria and the divided kingdom is in Ephraim's territory, so that's a sign of the seniority of his brother. Yeah.
The reversal of the blessing of birthright that Jacob gives to Joseph's two sons, is that in connection with the fact that Jacob himself stole his...
It could be, and perhaps Jacob knows better than anybody else what it means for the elder to receive, the younger to receive the elder blessing. Of course, Isaac was the firstborn to Abraham from Sarah. So, and that, right. But I think even within the bounds of legality, having been the son of this, like. Okay. Chapter 50. Is this all for real? Jacob dies. There's a massive funeral procession to Egypt, or to Canaan to bury him. Chapter 50, verse 15. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "It may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil we had did to him." So they sent a message to Joseph saying, oh, the conniving trickstery. Apple doesn't fall too far from the tree, apparently. Your father gave this command before he died. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgressions of your brothers and their sin, because they did evil to you. Jacob didn't say that. And now, please forgive the transgression of the servants of God, of the God of your father. Joseph wept when they spoke to him. So here he is weeping a fourth time. His brothers also came and fell down before him and said, behold, we are your servants. But Joseph said to them, do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear, I will provide for you and your little ones. Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Contrast that with him speaking roughly to them when he first re-meets them in chapter 42. The reconciliation here is total. Joseph's not holding anything back. He's not waiting for the moment to strike. Even if his brothers resort to that sort of old-fashioned trickery to like make sure they're not going to get screwed, it breaks Joseph's heart. You guys, we're good, all right? Just stop talking about it. You meant it for evil. Yep, you did. But God meant it for good. We're good. Totally forgives his brothers. No vengeance, no bitterness, no lingering anger. Joseph has so thoroughly given himself over as an instrument of God that he can look past all of these personal slights that come at him, even if they're bad. It's a remarkable sign of growth on Joseph's part, this haughty, arrogant, conniving 17-year-old boy, deliberately turning his brothers on each other, tattling on them, this bombastic guy. It's not who he is anymore. He's been transformed by God. All right, so what do we learn from the narrative of Joseph? What do we know about God from this narrative and how he works with us? Yeah. He's a God of redemption. Not just a God of blind justice. Were that the case, we'd all be in serious trouble. What else? We can change who we are. He can change who we are, absolutely. Yeah. Good. I like that. Yeah, Wendy. He plays the long game. It's so important for us to internalize in this narrative. We're always in a hurry. We don't like suffering very much either, and so we begged for it to be over with. God's much more patient than we are, generally. Yeah. Right? Yep. For it is God who is at work in you to will and to act according to his good pleasure, according to Paul in Philippians. God plays the long game. I think that is a very important lesson here for us who are often so keen for him to move more quickly than he does. Remember Joseph. Remember his 2 years in prison. Why did God make the cupbearer to forget? Joseph needs to learn this is because of God, not because of his own striving or maneuvering. God is in charge. Joseph is God's instrument. We know when he goes to prison that God is with him. The narrative tells us that. The characters in the story need to know that as well as we do. And so they have to go through this. But God is at work doing wonderful things. It also means that the way God works is almost always ineffable to us until it's done. We never know the whole story. God doesn't see fit to tell us. We have no reason to believe that God showed up to Joseph in prison and said, just wait it out a couple more years, Joseph. We'll figure this thing out together. No. Or, that God would orchestrate this great blessing both for the Egyptians and for his own promised people, covenant people, through this terrible hardship and suffering. Is it any wonder when Jesus looks at his own life through the lens of the story of his own people, he would say to his disciples in dismay after his resurrection, did you not know that the Messiah must first suffer these things before entering his glory? It's the story of his people. It's a pattern that replays over and over. Now, Jesus understands the narrative at its deepest level, which is why he is convinced the Messiah must suffer and die. Because how does Joseph enter his glory? But by a kind of death. And we'll see this pattern playing out again and again in the characters that we're looking at through the rest of the series this year. One other thing I think might be helpful for us, we have all these conversations in our culture these days about masculinity and femininity. Our culture doesn't know jack about masculinity and femininity. Joseph is overwhelmingly a manly figure. There's just no question about that. I mean, he's the prince of Egypt, for crying out loud. He's providing for the lives of thousands and thousands of people. There's no questioning that this is a man. And when he sees his brothers and he's confronted by raw humanity and he's confronted by the grandeur of God working in his life, he's not afraid to weep. And I think it tells us something about how there can be strength, from God's perspective at least, in tenderness. Remember that the definition of love from Christ's point of view is that he gives his life. It's not machismo. It's compassion. It's mercy. That's where true strength is to be found. And Joseph's strength is found that when he's finally given the chance to give it to his brothers after what they've done to him, he forgives them and provides for them and does the opposite for them of what they did to him. And his heart breaks for them, and he shows it. And so I think we can take a lesson from Joseph's peculiar brand of masculinity. It's not Marlboro Man, stiff upper lip, tough it out. It's raw, real humanity. It's compassion. It's from his guts. It's humility before God. That's what strength is. That's what masculinity is in our culture. Strength to forego our own prerogative, our own justice for the sake of mercy and service. That's love. That's masculinity. So let Joseph be a model to us as we rave in our culture about these issues. And the temptation is so strong to want to define masculinity in the face of the revisionists in that machismo, Marlboro Man way. That's not actually the answer to what their gripe. The answer is loving service, which requires to deny yourself like that requires incredible strength, character. Jesus did not consider equality with God something to be hoarded, grasped, taken advantage of, but emptied himself and became a servant. That's the definition of power. Okay, that's all for Joseph. The Biblical Bio series will continue. The next character we're looking at is King David. He's my favorite character in the Bible. So we'll start David actually in a few weeks' time. For the next 3 weeks, we're going to take a brief hiatus from the Biblical Biographies series, and as sort of a lead-in into preparing for Lent, we're going to talk about the Liturgy of Holy Communion in the prayer book. We're going to walk through it. We're going to look at the biblical basis of all the liturgy that we do, why the pieces are there, why they're in the order they're in, and why some of the extra ornamentals that we put on it here at Holy Trinity. Just to give you guys a sense for like what the intention is in the design of the worship we do here, so that as we enter into Lent, it can be a discipline of yours to enter more intentionally into the service of Holy Communion. Come here on Sunday morning. I've always found it very helpful in liturgical worship to know why things are the way they are. And the liturgy itself is so old that we can assume that none of it is haphazard or accidental, and that's actually true. It's all there for a reason. Many of those reasons, however, have been lost to our common understanding because we just don't spend time to look at it. But the beautiful thing about the prayer book liturgy is that it's fundamentally Christ-centered. And Cranmer's goal in reforming our liturgy and giving it to us the way he gave it to us is to increase our desire for Christ by exposing to us the grandeur of his love for us. And the whole liturgy is this great march of redemption through the gospel story. So we'll talk about that for the next 3 weeks on Wednesday night. And then after we're done with that, we'll return to the Biblical Bio series with King David.